Elizabeth Barrett as a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all struggle with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Hank.
Are you getting tired of that grandmother label yet?
No, I'm just starting to get into my groove with the grandmother label. And also you need to throw in there sibling. I am also a sibling.
Okay.
and I'm a sister-in-law. And those are important because today I want to expand our conversation out to those relationships that we have with our siblings to kind of piggyback on what we talked about last Tuesday when I brought up the idea of how can we come into this season of family gatherings and try to have some peace with our families of origin? How can we revisit those often challenging relationships of our childhood and not just survive getting together, but actually thrive and grow from those experiences? And I started talking about, or I introduced the work of Murray Bowen, who is one of the founding fathers of family therapy back in the 40s and 50s, along with Salvador Minuchin and Virginia Satir and Whitaker and this whole group of thinkers who started looking at families as an entire entity unto themselves. Prior to that, most therapy, most psychological focus was on the individual, and that each individual was seen as kind of existing unto themselves with their own neurosis or psychic disorders or individual experiences. But through the work of these founding fathers in the field of family therapy, we started to notice, recognize, and acknowledge that none of us exist in a bubble, that none of us are just solely our own people on the planet, that we are dependent and interdependent on each other. And so that switch came from focusing on each individual's neurotic tendencies and looking at the individual in the context of their relationships of the people in their family, how being a member of this family influenced the way this individual behaved or responded to the world around them and developed their own sense of personality or being. And that, along with their temperament and their biological makeup or their genetic makeup, would influence the entirety of the personality. So it's such a big and lofty conversation that I thought we need to continue on with this conversation because I hate leaving things seemingly unfinished. And because we're in this season of family gatherings, Thanksgiving being holiday part one, I thought we could continue on. And maybe by the time we hit New Year's, we'll have all kind of found this arc of experience where we've maybe healed some challenging relationships that have been bothering us over the course of the last however long, our lifetimes, and maybe find some joy in the activities and gatherings and family relationships over the next few months, or the next month at least. And having said that, it's interesting because I've been listening to all of the conversations about climate change and the climate summit and all the talk about the interconnectedness of the entire planet and this, you know, not new realization because it's something that's been understood for decades and decades, but just the growing conversation of the things we do in our daily lives on the planet impact not just our lives, but everyone in the world, that our ecological system is intertwined, that if we foul the waters, we kill the fish, right? If we foul the air, we kill ourselves. We have this interconnectedness that if we are pumping gases into the environment, we are going to change the entire world environment in such a way that it makes our lives uninhabitable. And that is precisely the idea that drove family therapy. Actually, back in the 1920s, there was a scientist, Burton Offley, who he was a biologist, actually, and he was the first one to start recognizing the ecological interconnectedness of all things, that you could not change a pond without impacting all of the living things in that pond and around it. And when he started making those biological and ecological connections, it changed the way scientists started addressing the natural world. And this process was transferred over to those early family therapists who started to realize that how a child behaves was in direct correlation to what they were experiencing within their family, and that the relationship between the parents would impact the behaviors and well-being of the children, and vice versa, the experiences of the children, their health, their temperament, their behaviors would impact the mental health and well-being of the parents. And this systemic view of families was revolutionary. And another part, along with the discovery of the biologists and the biology, the ecology, we also had social workers who were going into these very poor slums of New York City. And they were also recognizing that when children were removed from families, from homes, and given different experiences or treatment or, you know, a break away from the family, you know, kind of removed for a certain period of time, they might start to do really well, but once the children were returned to the family home, their behaviors would start to reoccur again. And so the social workers also started pointing out there is something to what happens within this family, within this house, that activates this child's behaviors. So here we are, 70, 80 years later, and we're seeing this climate conversation happening, this, you know, dire warning that we have to start looking at everything we do as impacting each other and the planet and the environment every single day. And this other idea of family and how our mental health and well-being is directly connected to those relationships with those in our family of origin. Our families are systems, and within that system, we all interact in ways that maintain our family's health or impact our families in such a way where the families have disconnects or breakdowns. What we look at from a family therapy standpoint is this idea of maintaining homeostasis, which is also a biological term, but that families relate to each other in such a way, the way they communicate, interact, behave, in such a way that they create their own kind of biosphere within the family, their homeostasis. And families may, from the outside, look like they're dysfunctional or chaotic or wild or quiet, whatever we may see from outside of a family system, that family has created their interactions in such a way that they've found a homeostasis. And anything we do that changes that, a family member gets sick, a family member develops a drug and alcohol addiction issue, somebody dies, anything that changes the interactions or the dynamic of that family throws the family homeostasis off and then causes these families to kind of go into turmoil. Another time that the family dynamics change is when a new member is born into the family, when there's a new baby. Then all of a sudden, all of these relationships and how we interact start to change. So today I thought that we'd continue this conversation about family systems, about Murray Bowen and his ideas of differentiation and the importance of making peace with our families of origin, and to extend it out to the role our sibling relationships play in our lives. Because it's interesting, when you look at research on family therapy, most of the relationship information is based on the parent-child. And when we go into therapy, most often the thing we're talking about is our conflicted relationships with our mothers and maybe our fathers. But rarely do people go into therapy to talk about conflicted relationships with siblings, although those relationships with our siblings can actually have as great an impact in our own personal development, our own sense of self-esteem and self-worth, as our relationships with our parents. And yet, it's not ever really a focus of family therapy or individual therapy. So I thought today we'd talk about some of the research into siblings. And I'm curious to know a couple of things. One, how was your holiday part one? How did that gathering with all of your extended family go? Or did you avoid that experience? But did you find yourself noticing more about those relationships? And two, I'd like you to think about your sibling relationships and how they've played a role in your life, and what those relationships are like for you today. Because one of the things that that is well known about sibling relationships is that although they may be the source of our greatest frustration and irritation when we're young, 82% of siblings report when they reach old age reconnecting with their siblings as adults and having stronger bonds sometimes than the bonds they've had with their spouses or with other relationships, their own children or with their parents, that we find our way back sometimes to our siblings and enjoy an incredibly close and dynamic relationship years down the road. And finally, in kind of a stretch way, and it might seem completely unrelated, but in my head it is, because we're talking about systems and how all things interact and influence each other, whether it's the climate, whether it's our families, but also what happens in our culture and how individuals or events may seem to be isolated, but in reality, they really are connected to what goes on in our culture, kind of the canary in the coal mine. Let me explain. I was thinking about the shooting at Planned Parenthood last week and the man that walked in and opened fire on this clinic, and the amount of what seemed to be random shootings, whether it's, you know, in the movie theater in Colorado or in the church in Charleston, you know, these acts of violence against others seem to be carried out by deranged individuals who, you know, had guns at their disposal and went in and did these unspeakable acts. But there's a part of me that always looks at these individuals. Maybe it's the therapist in me. But I look at these individuals and I try to understand what was their family of origin dynamic and how did that impact who they became today? You know, what was it like? Were they disconnected from their family system? Were they rejected from their family system? Were they, you know, in a family that came apart that was full of alcohol and drug abuse, or families that were very alienated from each other, that, you know, parents that were very disengaged? Because our children grow into adults who are a reflection of the experience they had in their families of origin. And not to forgive these behaviors and not to diminish the evil that is in these acts, but from a humanitarian position to try to understand what is it about being in the society and feeling outside, alienated, disconnected, that drives people to these acts of desperation. And then I also think that one of the things that Murray Bowen talked about was that our government is very much a reflection of our families, or our families are very much a reflection of our government. And when we have a government that is bullying smaller, weaker, less developed countries around the world, or we have a government that's unwilling to take a stand on the environment, or we have a government that is unwilling to make difficult decisions when it comes to saving money or reducing our debt, then it's very difficult for us to expect families to make those tough decisions, right? To stay together, to save money, to feel inspired to protect the environment, to feel inspired to maintain their relationships with their children, because we all are connected and families are a reflection of the values of our government. And so these people who get to the fringe of society and go off and do these unthinkable acts, I think quite often are the canary in the coal mine, that representation of how disconnected people feel from a common good in our culture. And that might have been way off in left field, but those things have been on my mind because I keep thinking about how we have this moral contract with each other as human beings to look out for each other, to offer support, to stay connected. And as families, we have a contract, a social contract, to look out for those members of our family who may not be participating in the family system in ways that we'd like them to, but they still are part of our extended family. And what is it we owe them? Or do we push them out and make them the problem of our culture? And when we have a lot of people who have been dismissed or disengaged from their family system, where do they end up? I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Thank you for tuning in. As Hank said earlier, we get together every Tuesday and talk about those things that go on in our lives and impact our mental health and well-being. And I invite you to be part of the conversation, 805-781-3875. I'm curious to know how your Thanksgiving weekend went. What came up for you? Was there anything that went well? Was there anything that you struggled with? Anything we can maybe talk about today that might help the next gatherings go more smoothly? I'm happy to hear from you. And also, I'm curious to know what your relationship was with your siblings. How did those relationships influence who you became today? Or did you ever think about that? And how is your relationships with your siblings today? And also, I want to make sure that I talked about parenting children a little bit today and talk about some of those things we do as parents that actually fuel the sibling rivalries and don't really help our children to find their own way in their relationships down the road. So I'm hoping we'll have time to get to all of those things. 805-781-3875. You can also be part of our conversation by checking out our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. If you like us, you'll get information about shows that are coming up. I'm not great about posting all the time. I try. I always get the topic for the week up there, but I don't post often, so you won't be overwhelmed with information. But you can also contact us through our website, thereluctanttherapist.com. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. And you can listen to previous shows at our wonderful website, kcbx.org. Or if you're technologically savvy, you can go to your iTunes account and go under podcasts, look up The Reluctant Therapist and hit subscribe, and you'll get all of the shows downloaded to the device of your choice. And the thing that's interesting is that I somehow don't remember doing this, but I was looking on my phone, which I'm not totally adept with, but I was looking at my phone and I noticed that there is a podcast app on there, and I opened it and all of my shows have been downloaded. So either one of my children or my kind husband did a subscription to my own show, and they're all on my phone. But I never cease to be amazed by how we have access to information all the time, thanks to a lot of the technology that's been introduced. And it also, you know, we talk a lot about the negative aspects of technology, but I think again about the importance of our family systems and how being engaged and connected to our extended family is so good for our mental health and well-being, that we have the opportunities to connect through technology in ways that we never had before. You know, I think about being able to hit a button on my phone and be able to see my daughter's face all the way over in Chicago. It's amazing to me that we have that ability to stay close. So the conversation today, as I said, is visiting Murray Bowen and our founding fathers of family therapy, but I want to focus a bit on siblings and sibling relationships and why they are the way they are and what we know about them. 805-781-3875, if you'd like to chime in with your experience. We'll start with Larry. What's on your mind today?
Hi. This isn't about sibling relationship, but there's a problem between my wife and my daughter, mm-hmm. and they both seem to assume the worst about each other and their intentions, and I'm constantly getting stuck in the middle. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you had any advice on that kind of a situation.
It's tough to be the third person in that dynamic, isn't it, Larry?
It sure is.
And what do you tend to do?
Well, I try to listen to both of them and, you know, be the peacemaker, the rational one. It's ironically the same position my mother had between my father and I. Mm-hmm. So I'm familiar with this situation a little bit, but it's just very, very frustrating. I love them both so much, and I hate to see them, you know, relating in such a difficult manner.
And how old is your daughter?
She's 29.
29. So I imagine she's off on her own and has her own family at this point?
Oh, yeah. She's married and living in Boston and doing very well. And her mother and I are retired here in San Luis Obispo.
And so was this dynamic the same when she was young and lived at home, or did it change over time?
Yeah, ever since adolescence, it's been very difficult, but it seemed to recede a while after she moved out, became an adult, But lately it's cropped up. Now it's complicated by the fact that we just lost my father-in-law, my wife's father and her grandfather, and they were very close.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of grieving that's going on.
Yeah, I think the grieving is complicating things.
Absolutely. And is your daughter an only child, or does she have siblings?
She is an only child.
So there's a lot of focus, I'm sure, and energy, right, that's focused on your daughter while she was growing up. And adolescents who are only children tend to rebel a little bit from all of that attention because they need to strike out on their own and find their own way. So you were probably ready for her to go out into the world and make her way.
She went through a huge rebellion, and we worried about her as a teenager, but then she got her act together and, ended up getting a bachelor's and a master's degree, and, she's in a profession and happily married. I mean, everything should be going well.
And so what is it that seems to be the trigger for your wife and your daughter? What is the thing that seems to set them off?
They'll interpret what each other says mm-hmm. in the worst possible way. They'll just take whatever is said as a criticism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're very sensitive to what the other
person... extremely sensitive people anyway, and hypersensitive to each other, it seems.
So the good news is the fact that they continue to have these, even though there are arguments, these difficulties, they're still committed to being a family, right? They're no one is backing down. Everyone is still trying to stay engaged, even if they're not getting the result that they want. They continue to try to be in relationship with each other.
Yeah, there's a lot of love there. Mm-hmm. I'm just concerned that, it's going to go too far and there'll be an alienation. Because I went through that with my dad. It was horrible. Fortunately, we made up before he passed away, or it would have been much worse.
And so that was the other thing I wanted to address, because I think the reason this is so distressing for you, it's watching your childhood and adult experience replay itself again. And once again, you feel helpless to really improve the situation.
That's the worst part of it.
It is the worst part. And to throw out, the Bowenian term to you, you have been triangulated in this conflict between your wife and your daughter. And unfortunately, one of the only ways to kind of help that relationship heal is to remove yourself from that conflict. My concern is that you somehow, in trying to be the buffer, are allowing that relationship to stay conflicted, because they can continue, instead of addressing each other and trying to find healing or trying to find a common love for each other, they just kind of, they both stand in their corner and wait for you to referee. And if you remove yourself from that position and just say, I love you both, and you clearly love each other, and you need to find your way to that place, that's kind of the only way they're going to do it. Because as long as you're in the mix of that, neither one of them will have to take the high road and say, look, I love you, and let's figure this out.
You're right. They both come running to me with their complaints about the other one. So the response to that should be, I love you both. Mm-hmm. I can't get in between you. Right. You guys are going to have to work this problem out.
Yes. So, and to really firmly and lovingly say, I love you both. There is so much love between the two of you. You need to have this conversation together. You need to figure this out together, because this is your relationship and I can't be a part of it. And I think that it may not, happen overnight, but it'll help your stress. It'll reduce your stress greatly by removing yourself from feeling like you are somehow responsible for helping to heal that relationship. And two, it'll kind of put them in the position of having to face whatever their issue is, because right now they get to avoid the issue by coming to you and complaining.
I'm going to try that.
Okay. I hope that works. And I also, I appreciate you recognizing that there is also the element of grief. And when we grieve, we tend to lash out at those we love around us for, because we fear losing more people that we love. And sometimes we, you know, put up barriers because we don't want to experience pain again. And so, you know, grief shows itself in strange ways. So to keep supporting your wife and your daughter in their grieving process, how hard it is to lose someone that we love and that we can only hold on to who we have, you know, as we carry on.
I know that's complicating it. And hospice has offered some grief counseling. I encourage my wife to go to that, but I don't know. It sounds like it might be a group situation. She's not comfortable talking in front of people about this.
Yeah, and I would imagine she's very private. And yeah. And I think the best thing, again, that it's hard. Again, it sounds like you so want to be able to do something. But really, the only thing you can do is to give her the space to feel the feelings and to keep saying the same thing. If I could take the pain, I would. I can't. But I'll sit with you whenever you want and hold your hand and just be here. If you want to cry, yeah. You want to talk, or you just want to be quiet, because grief is a really individual experience. We can only, a very personal experience that we have to live through ourselves.
Yeah. I appreciate it, Elizabeth, and I like your show very much and appreciate all the help you're giving to people.
Well, Larry, thank you for taking the time to call, because you're the reason I come here every Tuesday.
Thank you.
I wish you well. Please call me back and let me know how it goes, okay?
I may do that.
I'm happy to keep working with you, Larry. Have a good afternoon.
Thanks.
Thank you. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875. And yes, we're always talking about all things family that impact our lives. Nothing impacts our mental health and well-being more than those relationships we have or don't have with our family, our extended family, and as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, our siblings. So let's talk a little bit about those sibling relationships and why they are the way they are. There's research that's been done by Frank Sulloway that looked at our birth positions and birth orders and how, where we ended up in our family system, how it influences our personalities. As an oldest child in my family, it makes sense that I'm kind of bossy, that I see things very black and white. I have a very strong sense of what I believe is the right way to do things. Oldest children tend to have a lot of leadership qualities. They end up being the de facto parents in the family, in some ways helping out with their younger children. Oldest siblings tend to have more neurotic tendencies than younger siblings. Also because oldest children, like only children, get all of the parental psychic energy and all of the parental anxiety kind of focused on them. And they react in with much more neurotic behaviors, tend to be more anxious, more depressed. And again, it's because there's so much of the parental attention on these children to be all things these parents dreamed of, right? To be the smartest, brightest, most athletic, most beautiful, the reflection of these parents and how good they are. And for many parents, just as Murray Bowen talked about, many parents are trying to heal the broken experience they had growing up in their own family by parenting their children a different way. And here's the tricky, slippery slope of Murray Bowen's family therapy theory, is that not only are we systems and our behaviors influence each other, right? That if mom is mad at dad, the kids feel that anger and they lash out against each other. Or if mom and dad have a very conflicted relationship, the oldest child will tend to try to be very well behaved so that the parents will stop fighting with each other. Like, the systems all interact. All of our behaviors are in response to what's happening in our family. Well, the same is seen intergenerationally, that what happens in our parents' generation, they repeat in our generation and will repeat in the next generation. We see it very commonly in addiction, that if there's drug and alcohol abuse in one generation, it gets passed on down generation after generation. Even if the family's aware of the addictions, somehow these patterns of behavior get passed along. It's the same with patterns of divorce or patterns of staying married, our religious beliefs. And then we see things like cutoffs in the family. If there is a cutoff between a mother and her daughter one generation, you can see that passed down to the next generation, where either siblings will cut off their relationship with each other, or the mother will end up having a strained relationship with her daughter. And the thing that's so painful about these patterns is that we go into our next generations always hoping that we're going to heal the broken experiences we had the generation before us. But it doesn't work that way. And that's why Murray Bowen's work was so important, because he talked about the need to heal those family relationships from our original family, come to some sort of peace with those relationships, to have some sort of relationship with our extended family members, so that we would not pass down those broken patterns to our children and our next generation. You see, you can't just wish to have a better relationship with your children than you had with your parents. You actually have to go back and heal those relationships in some way. It doesn't mean moving back in, or, you know, singing kumbaya together, or everything's joyful, but coming to some understanding of why those relationships were the way they were, why they were conflictual, why, you know, our parents responded in the way they did. And when we can understand that, we can have a better chance of having a healthier relationship with our own children. So then let's again go back to the siblings. The reason sibling relationships are so complex is because although we may be born into the same family with the same parents, because of our temperament and our genetic makeup, we all respond to that environment that we were born into differently. And as Frank Soloway talked about, our birth order influences how we react to that family system. So I think often about my relationship with my brother. And I'm the oldest sibling, and my brother's 18 months younger than I am. And when I was born, being the oldest child, you know, there's all that parental attention. And then 18 months later, my brother was born, and my 18-month-old self felt that threat of having this new person in the family system and started feeling very competitive for my parents' attention. And because of that, it set up this lifetime or this childhood of being at odds with my brother. He was always unconsciously that threat to my relationship with my parents. And then, of course, my brother ended up being, you know, kind of the golden boy. And so you have all of those other dynamics that go on in the family that set us up as siblings to be at odds with each other. And my brother and I definitely were at odds all the way through our childhood. We were best friends and frenemies and enemies all at the same time, because siblings tend to spend the majority of time together when they're young. You spend more time with your siblings when you're young than you do with people outside of the family. So you're kind of stuck being each other's playmate and combatant at the same time. And the thing that's interesting about those childhood sibling relationships is not only are we having a different experience, even though we have the same home and the same parents, we each respond to what's going on in our family based on our sensitivities, based on our temperaments, based on how we experience things. But biologically, we all are fighting, siblings are fighting for parental attention, because biologically, in order to survive out of childhood, each child needs the parental resources like food and shelter and warmth and medicine. And, you know, prior to the 1800s, half of all children didn't live out of childhood, didn't make it past the age of one. So you can imagine that old evolutionary connection between childhood resources and survival. And so now that we have the ability to keep almost all children alive all the way through childhood, we still have that very biological tendency to be in competition with each other for parental attention. And remember, this is all subconscious. It's no one is consciously trying to do each other in. It's kind of a survival instinct in siblings. But then it gets carried over into these bigger conflicts. We're talking about sibling rivalry. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And I'd love to hear from you, because I can talk a lot about these sibling relationships, but I'm curious to know what your sibling relationship is all about. And does this resonate with you at all? And how were these family dynamics playing out over your holiday season? 805-781-3875. It's a number to be part of this conversation. You're listening to Public Radio KCBX. We'll be back to take your calls.
You're listening to Public Radio KCBX. The number to call today to be part of the conversation is 805-781-3875.
So it's interesting because our sibling relationships, again, can be the most fraught with tension, but they can also end up being our greatest source of comfort, especially in our old age or older age. I'm not sure what I mean by old age, if that's 60, 70, or 80, whatever that is. But we tend to kind of come back to our siblings at some point in our life. And the natural progression of things for siblings is to be very close when they're young. And then as we get into adolescence, we tend to go off into our own relationships with those outside of our family. And then we get into our 20s, and our sibling relationships become much less important as we partner up, get married, have children, and we can kind of lose our connection to our siblings. And again, that old sibling rivalry tends to rear itself as we're raising children because there's a lot of competition to have, you know, the best marriages and the best behaved children. And so those family dynamics get all kind of strange while we're raising children because we feel very sensitive if our parents, you know, seem to like the other grandchildren more than our grandchildren, or that we perceive that our brothers or sisters are getting more attention than we are. You know, those feelings we had as children in the home of feeling like things weren't fair, or our parents didn't favor us, or another child was more important, they tend to carry out while we're raising our own children because we are very sensitized to wanting to feel special in our parents' eyes. But then when our own children grow and our parents are aging, we see another transition in sibling relationships when it comes to caring for our elderly parents. Because siblings now, instead of being in competition for their parents' attention, that's gone, and the siblings can come together and work together in trying to care for their parents in the best way possible. 40% of the time, that's the way things work out, that siblings find this closeness, this way to reconnect, this bond together. But the other 40% of the time, another 40% of the time, it can be a source of real conflict once again for siblings as old insecurities come up once again, or generally the oldest sibling or one sibling ends up being the primary caregiver of parents, and there's a lot of resentment. So we can do things as we grow to try to heal those relationships with our siblings so that we can work in tandem to care for our elderly parents, but also to enjoy what is considered the greatest gift, which is reconnecting with those siblings in our old age and being able to share a lifetime of history and of stories in a way that's less threatening, less competitive, but more sweet and nuanced as we age. And I'm curious if that connects with you. 805-781-3875. Sandra, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. I have two sisters, and my younger sister and I don't speak, and I see, as you're talking about this today, I see how this is multi-generational. My dad was estranged from his sister, and there was a lot of conflict in his family, and growing up, there was just a lot of fighting, and my dad is a very difficult personality, and now I see this between my younger sister and I. I don't feel like we were ever taught to how to get along, not only explicitly, but through modeling. There was just not a lot of social, there wasn't a good social example of how to communicate well and civilly and be kind to one another. And I don't want to see that repeat with my kids, and I want to be a good model for them, and I feel conflicted. I go to therapy, and I've been working through a lot of this, and I feel like I'm doing a pretty good job with my kids and showing them and modeling for them, but I always have this nagging feeling about my younger sister, about whether or not to try to reconnect, because it's become sort of a wedge in the family. I mean, with the holidays, it's kind of choosing, we're never all together anymore, and I don't know what to do about it.
What's the age difference between you, Sandra?
3.5, almost 4 years.
And is there a sister or a brother between you?
Oh, I'm the middle.
You're the middle.
And it's 3 sisters.
Okay. And how's your relationship with your older sister?
Fine. We can annoy one another, but it never lasts. Everything. She's across the country, though, so it's not as intense of a relationship either.
Right, you have some distance.
There's distance, but when we do see each other, we get along well.
And how about your oldest sister and your youngest sister? How's their relationship?
It's okay. I think it can be pretty tense when they are together, because the younger sister is a very intense personality. Mm-hmm. And very sensitive. And I think we're all 3 sensitive in different ways, but there's no hesitation to fight or bring things up in a very aggressive way.
Mm-hmm. And usually right at a family gathering, because you don't probably socialize with each other outside of these gatherings, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like many, many holidays have been ruined with fights.
So here's what I'm gonna throw out to you. Because I'm on my Murray Bowen kick, and I encourage you to read some of his work if you're interested, because I don't have enough time to go into details about his work with intergenerational patterns, but it's fascinating. And his belief with family therapy was that the more insight we have into the workings of our family system, right? Why our parents behaved the way they did, why does our siblings behave the way they do? The more insight we have, the more healing that can occur. That mm-hmm. was really his thing. The other thing that he really encouraged was letter writing, that it's very difficult to talk about very charged, sensitive issues face to face without someone feeling defensive or attacked, right? So he was a big believer in writing letters to try to bridge distances in relationships, because someone could read the letter and think about it and respond or not respond, but they wouldn't feel on the spot by like that confrontational conversation. And to even talk in the letter about, you know, is there a time we could get together and talk about, you know, how we could heal this relationship or not? Maybe you write this letter about your feelings growing up in the home and how you'd like things to be different and make it different for your daughter. And maybe you don't send the letter. Maybe the act of writing a letter helps give you peace. But I encourage you to sit down and really think about, what would it take for this relationship to be at peace for me? Mm-hmm. And given that I can't change my sister, and I understand her intensity and the sensitivities, given that I can't ever change her, how could I respond differently that might help to lower the reactivity we have when we're together?
Mm-hmm.
And I encourage you to do those things, because you're exactly right that without healing that, you run the risk of your own children having those same kind of cutoffs. And it's not conscious. It's kind of an unconscious pattern. And I saw this with my mother-in-law, who had a cutoff with her sister and now subsequently has had a cutoff with her daughter, who is now subsequently having a cutoff with her daughter. And I've seen this as an outsider. I think this is so painful and unnecessary. But it takes one person being willing to put aside their feelings, right, a little bit, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. just give grace to the other family members for the health of the whole family system.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
So I encourage you to put the letter down. And the other key thing is that when we want to address family issues and things that are painful, it's important to know what would help heal it, and not just say, I'm feeling sad or hurt or angry, but to say, I feel these things, but I believe that if we could, you know, agree that we both love each other and that's all that really matters. Or if we could spend an hour having lunch and talk about things unrelated to family, like to come up with some thing that might help heal the relationship is really mm-hmm. important. So, you know, to state our feelings, but also to say, here's how I think we could make things better.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mm-hmm. help?
It does. Thank you very much.
Sandra, I appreciate you calling. Enjoy the rest of your holiday season.
Thank you.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Brianna, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I just want to thank you for bringing all this into awareness. And it got me thinking, I have a very severed relationship with my own mother. And as a result of her really extreme bipolar disorder, and so that's really not any fault of her own, but my childhood growing up with her was extremely mentally abusive, emotionally abusive, oftentimes leading on occasion to physical abuse. And so she chooses not to medicate herself properly, and she oftentimes resorts to drugs and alcohol to help herself during her cycling between, you know, how bipolar disorder is. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, she's a very difficult person to know and get along with, and you never know what you're going to, what you can expect with her. And over the years, and kind of culminating into her almost ruining my wedding, the day before my wedding, I decided, you know, no longer. I'm going to set healthy boundaries for myself until she chooses to do the work she needs to do to manage her bipolar disorder. I can't be a part of her life. And I struggle with that. It's been years now, and she continually reaches out to me and wants to be a part of my life and now my children's lives. And she will forget the things that I say to her, you know, like, well, these are the reasons I've been hurt in the past, and these are the things that I would need in order to repair the relationship. And she'll get right back into her old patterns of being really emotionally abusive towards me, and we make no headway, and it always results with me saying, this is why I don't talk to you, and I can't continue to talk to you until you get help. But when I heard what you said about that potential of my child and I continuing that cycle, I just panicked. It's like, oh my gosh, I just can't imagine that. My children are small and they're boys, but I can't imagine not having them in my life in the future. And I just wanted to ask you, where is the line between setting healthy boundaries for yourself and for the people around you that are close to you that you love, versus at what point are you making a detriment to the relationships you're trying to foster in your current life, because old demons, you know, die hard.
Yeah, they do. Well, and Brianna, thank you for sharing your story, because I think a lot of people resonate with this, and it's the question I get most often is, mm-hmm. you know, I hear what you're saying. I should have a relationship with my family, but for these reasons, this family member is next to impossible to have a relationship with. And here's mm-hmm. a couple things you've done really well. You have continued to love your mother, and you've given her grace as much as you can for, you know what, here was her limited capacity as my mom. She did right. the best she could with her limited capacity. And mm-hmm. and you sound like you are at peace with that. Although your childhood yeah. was far from ideal, you're able to step away and say, you know, this is the mom I got. And so I yeah. will love her for the ways that she was good, and the other ways I will set boundaries. So mm-hmm. good for you, because that's a setup for your generation with your children being stronger. Because what you will do is understand, we can't just wish that we're not like our parents. We have to make active changes to be different with our children. And so what right. I'm hearing you say is, I will respect my children, right? I'm not going to be physically abusive or mentally abusive,
no.
right? But at the same time, I'm going to allow my children space to develop and be who they are, and allow them to be, you know, angry at me when they need to be angry, and not feel like I need them to love me all the time because I didn't love my own mom. You see, that's where the right. mess kind of right. gets, is that you might end up being extra needy for their love and attention to prove to yourself that you were a better mom than your mom was to you. And then you inadvertently Ooh. Set your children up for thinking, God, mom, you're so needy. And you're you right. know what I'm saying? It's like, it's unconscious the way that we set up this pattern. So if you can be at peace with, you know what, I know that I've done the best I can with my skills as a parent for my children, and I'm going to trust that they're going to love me and recognize that, and without me needing them to affirm that for me all the time.
Oh, that's powerful stuff right there.
Does that help a little bit, though?
Yeah, that helps a lot. It helps a lot, because I just you know, was listening to you driving in the car going, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. You know, you feel that panic rise up.
I hear it.
I thought I was doing everything I can.
You are. But just don't overcompensate, because then you'll push them away for other reasons, right? We can almost love them too hard. And along with your mom, honey, I encourage you, because I'm kind of big in that letter writing thing with Murray Bowen, you know, write your mom a letter. Again, remind her how much you love her and how difficult it must be to try to parent and be a mom dealing with her bipolar disorder. And here are the ways that I can be with you, and here are the ways it doesn't work. And just to, because in writing might be the only thing that sticks.
Yeah. I've written her letters in the past, and she'll read them and do what she needs to do in the immediate, but then it usually falls apart. So we have been down that road, but it's worth looking into again. I'm always open and willing to try new things. I just want it to be in a safe environment, which is what it hasn't been in the past. So.
And I can't applaud you enough for the thoughtfulness that you are approaching both of these things with, because it'd be very easy to cut your mom off and try to make it all go away. And the fact that you're trying to find healthy ways to engage and stay separate is a huge kudos to you, Brianna. So keep it up.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
Call anytime. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. We're talking about those challenging relationships that are our families, and how do we find healthy ways to engage and disengage and still feel connected to those most important relationships in our lives. Suzanne, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi.
Hi.
We have a definite family split, and this has definitely resonated with me in an extreme way. Mm-hmm. I actually have a brother, and he's my only sibling, who lives just a few blocks away. And some about 15 years ago, he decided, mostly I think at the prodding of his wife, who had a very difficult childhood herself, that he would have nothing to do with either me, my husband, or my children. He has not spoken to us except for once since. I wrote a few letters and said, wow, if there's anything I've done to upset you, I'm truly sorry. I mean, I tried to extend, and I just never got a response even, and it's painful.
It's incredibly painful. And how are you? Where do you fall in your sibling order, Suzanne?
I am the oldest. Mm-hmm. I am a lot like you described the oldest being, and he is the second child. It's just the two of us.
And so here's the other part of the dynamic that I didn't talk about, is that when we're in our sibling relationships, we talk about those niches, right? And that we each kind of inhabit this place. And our parents somehow, sometimes inadvertently or consciously, set us into these roles that kind of set up a dynamic that doesn't work with our siblings. Maybe they said, you know, your sister's the smart one. Your sister's always well-behaved. Why can't you, you know, be as outgoing or as studious or as, you know, as compliant as your sister? And these things that, and I don't know if these were said in your home, but sometimes these things are said, and the younger siblings take that on, and they figure, you know, my niche is outside of this family system, that this place doesn't support me, or I can't be the smartest one, I can't be the most thoughtful one. And so it kind of sets younger siblings in this direction of being outside of the family system. In other ways, also, you mentioned that, you know, his relationship with his wife. And if we had 2 hours, I would talk about how it is we choose our partners, because we choose our marital partners in a way of balancing or complementing whatever that part of our childhood didn't work for us.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like your brother married someone very similar to you. And that is... sets it up to be kind of a power struggle between a very strong wife and a very strong sister. And the very strong wife is always going to win.
Oh, sure.
And so the good news, bad news is, it doesn't mean that this is the pattern forever. That things do change, that the more secure your brother becomes in his life. And sometimes it takes people into their 60s to feel secure and comfortable in their own lives. And then they come back.
We are there.
Oh, you're there. Okay, good.
At that age, yes.
You sound very young.
I kept hoping things would shift and change. Now, our stepmother, both of our parents are deceased. Mm-hmm. Our stepmother just died a couple of months ago, and my stepsister actually called him and invited him to come to the memorial, and he basically declined, letting her know that he was busy, and he kind of hemmed and hawed, and he did not show up. My male children, I had four children, three are boys. One of the boys in particular was heartbroken mm-hmm. over the loss of this uncle that he really adored, and it's been hard on him too.
And has he reached out to his uncle separate from you?
He asked me how I would feel about it, and I said, you know what, I just don't want to see you get hurt, but go right ahead. If it's important to you, I encourage you. And he, I guess that was maybe kind of ambivalent, and he didn't do it. I don't know.
So I would, and you answered your own question, and it kind of goes along with the Bowenian idea of our extended family relationships, that for whatever reason, the psychic energy of your brother and the rest of his family is too intense for him, but it doesn't mean that he can't develop these relationships with nephews or cousins. And I think it's up to your son to reach out and see if he can heal that relationship or to have forged some sort of relationship. Because as Murray Bowen said, it doesn't mean that we're going to have, you know, great connected relationships with every person we're related to. That's not realistic. But if right. we continue to kind of reach out, we'll find different people in that extended family that we do feel connected to. And it might be that the next generation is less threatening to your brother than his immediate generation. And that's all your son can do. And hopefully you have a good 20 more years with your brother, that things will come around. Because it's interesting, the last research study I read right before we went on the air was about people in their 80s actually having the closest relationship with their siblings. So you've got some time, my friend.
Okay, well, I will absolutely encourage my son to. I mean, I kind of gave him an ambivalent answer, which didn't encourage, obviously.
Yeah, so maybe take another stab at it and then encourage your son to find his own way with that and see if it helps. It might heal that generational split.
I will encourage that.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. And today we've been talking about our challenges in our family relationships. And I'm sorry that I couldn't get to the last two callers today, but I'm happy to continue this conversation next week or the week after that, because as I said, these weeks around the holiday seasons tend to bring up a lot of old family issues and family concerns. And I feel like we barely got to scratch the surface when it came to sibling relationships, because we do learn so much about love and life and friendships from our siblings. We learn that love and hate can quickly follow each other, that when we are with our siblings within 5 minutes, we can love each other and we can be battling. We learn with our siblings that sometimes being a parent's favorite can be as burdensome as not being the favorite at all. We learn from our siblings that there's a thin line between a tight hug and strangulation, and that we can come to know our own desire to hurt others, but also become aware of our ability to be nurturing as well. And that we can pick on our siblings inside of the house, but outside of the home, no one comes after our family because we all defend each other. Our sibling relationships help to help us learn about how we will love others in our lives, whether it's our marriages, our friendships, or our relationships with our parents. So I encourage you to think about those sibling relationships and how you can grow them or reconnect with them or have grace for the experience of growing up in the same house together, but with very different temperaments and experiences of being in that family. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This has been A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. Please join us on Facebook or check us out on thereluctanttherapist.com. Listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. And as always, I thank you for supporting Public Radio KCBX.